Hello there, I'm Chris Difford. Welcome to my podcast, I Never Thought It Would Happen, made in collaboration with Help Musicians. Help Musicians is an amazing charity that has been aiding artists for 100 years, supporting a myriad of music creators throughout the UK. In each episode of this podcast, I'll be joined by musician friends to discuss their careers. In this episode, I'll be joined by a truly versatile chap. He was born in Rochester, Kent, and from a very young age, he turned his hand to classical and flamenco guitar, piano, sitar, and tabla. He later studied law, explored comedy. Oh my God, goodness gracious me. But music was always his main inspiration. He has written and recorded with Paul McCartney, Brian Eno, Jeff Beck, Ellie Goulding, Horace Andy, Sinead O'Connor, and the list goes on and on. And then there's theatre, cinema, television, radio, video games, DJing, awards, so many of them and so well deserved. So please welcome the incredibly talented Nitin Sawhney. Hi Nitin, welcome to I Never Thought It Would Happen, a podcast for the charity Help Musicians. How are you?
I'm very well, thanks. How are you?
I'm good, and it's nice to be chatting with you in this sort of safe way, at a distance. How have you found it?
Oh my God, well, there's a whole variety of different feelings about it, but I had COVID in October. That was pretty tough, pretty full on, but I've been working a lot. I've been writing music for films and also making my album and producing Jules' album, which has been fun. And yeah, just kept myself busy. I mean, it's frustrating not being able to travel or tour. I mean, I kind of realised how much of my life I live in other countries and in the air. So that's been weird. Also, I guess, you know, not being able to see people as frequently and as easily as normal is frustrating too. But I mean, most of all, it's been very sad to watch how much the pandemic has affected so many lives and taken so many lives. So yeah, it's been a difficult time from that point of view very much.
It's been quite incredible how Help Musicians have been reaching out to the tune of over £17 million to songwriters and composers around the country, helping them survive. It's been really tough for them, of course.
Absolutely, and I think Help Musicians is fantastic, and I've been working a lot. As you probably know, I'm chair of the PRS Foundation, and we also, not to that degree, but raised money for a hardship fund as well. So we did a couple of concerts last year, and I did one also for the Royal Albert Home series as well as the PRS Foundation. But it never feels like it's enough, because you see, I mean, well, musicians are just, as we all know, are just the most neglected area by this government and by these times. And just watching what's happened has just been really frustrating.
When you were at school, who was your favourite teacher?
Wow. So probably when I was at junior school was somebody called Mrs. Shelton. And I think it was probably because she kind of inspired me with art and creativity a lot. And then when I got to senior school, it was Mr. Roberts, who was an English teacher, and he taught English and art as well. And I really liked him. He was very funny. He had a great sense of humour. There were a few. I mean, there was Mr. McAvoy as well, who was also very funny, but very good at encouraging debate in the class. And I really loved all of that. I loved that. For me, was the time when my mind felt like it had been given permission to express itself within a safe space. It's kind of, I think that's very important, because, you know, up until then, I'd experienced a lot of racism and a lot of frustrating situations where I'd felt like it was best to keep quiet. So I think when I met Mr. McAvoy, he totally changed everything. And he actually also encouraged me to write poetry, which till then I'd thought was just not something to do because it would be laughed at by other kids and so on. So when he actually said, I'd love to read your poetry or bring it to me, I'd very happily look at it and talk to you about it. And that was amazingly encouraging. And it meant that I ended up writing a lot more, and that got me into lyrics as well.
It only takes one teacher, doesn't it?
Yeah, definitely. That's the thing. It's amazing at that age, around 14, 15 as well, is the time when you're looking for validation in lots of ways. Yeah, I really felt that. I really felt genuinely validated, and it really helped, because I'm not going to run down other teachers or anything like that, but I just feel that there was a sense of somebody you could genuinely talk to on a level that was not based in condescension or about their position over you. And he was somebody who just felt like he was very open to listening. So, yeah, that changed a lot for me, actually.
Yeah, I went to an all-boys school in Deptford, and it was very masculine. And, you know, me writing poetry when I was at school was frowned upon. And sometimes, you know, I'd get the slipper for sitting there writing poetry and for my mind wandering. But then a young teacher from Goldsmiths College came in, and she brought a record player, and she put it in the art room and started playing records. And that was what turned me on to the idea that I could be a songwriter. Did you have that kind of moment?
That's really interesting, because it's the same. I mean, I was at an all-boys grammar school in Rochester in Kent, and it was a very masculine kind of atmosphere. Quite a lot of bands came out of there as well, you know, like The Prisoners, and a lot of kind of punk-based bands were coming out of that school. So it was a very kind of macho kind of environment. But at the same time, I think that's my point, when Mr. McAvoy kind of literally... I'd never been in an environment like that where everyone was able to discuss what was going on within a book and really kind of think about the psychology of the characters and what was happening and really get into the emotions of the characters and think about that. And I think that still today has really helped me with things like film scoring, you know, really understanding characters, understanding narrative and journeys. And I think narrative is everything to me, you know, so whether that's on an album or whether that's in a... even if you're DJing, you know, whatever you're writing, whatever you're creating, I always think about that dramatic arc and how that works. You know, even in a piece of poetry, it might be subliminal, but it's actually about the journey of that poem or lyrics, you know. So I always look at that, and I think that time was definitely formative for me in lots of ways.
Did you have a close friend at school who you enjoyed music with? You'd like say, well, listen to this album, it's brilliant, sort of thing.
Yeah, it was James Taylor from the James Taylor Quartet.
Oh my God,
really? He was my best mate at school. So, and is still a very close friend who lives still in Rochester. We would listen to loads of music together and actually jam together. In fact, the first time I met him was in the school practice rooms, where we started playing around on the blues scale. I taught him the blues scale. I knew it from somebody else who taught it to me a few years before that. But the reason I showed it to him was because he was really into Oscar Peterson. And we were both listening to Oscar Peterson or watching his shows quite late at night. And we chatted about that. And then we found that we had a lot in common in terms of music that we really liked, which ranged through a whole load of different things. And he was really interested in Indian classical music. And he was fascinated by the fact that I played tabla as well a little bit. We used to jam all the time. And later on, I ended up playing as well guitar with the James Taylor Quartet. And a few years ago, I was commissioned to write the first commission for the pipe organ at the Royal Albert Hall. And of course, I asked James to play it, which was amazing. I was banging away on the taiko drums because I thought, I don't know how I'm going to match the scale of that incredible pipe organ. But he's amazing because he was funny, a really cool bloke without trying to be. I mean, just interesting, you know, and just thoughtful. So, yeah, I really enjoyed his company very much.
When you're at home, was there much music?
Yeah, there was a lot of music. From an early age, I was hearing a lot of Indian classical music from both my mum and dad. But my dad also had a very eclectic taste. He listened to a lot of Cuban music, a lot of flamenco, which got me into flamenco guitar, a lot of crooners. He loved Frank Sinatra and all that stuff and Nat King Cole. But also a lot of jazz. He was really into jazz, so I'd listen to a lot of that. I guess I would put on a lot of Western classical music, probably because I was playing a lot of classical music on the piano. But then my brothers would be playing Led Zeppelin, The Doors, a lot of that. There was Radio Caroline was on a lot. Those personal top 30s you'd get on Sunday evenings. What was it, 6:30? And I love that idea. You don't get that anymore. You know, the idea that people would just put together their personal top 30s and a radio station would play the whole top 30 of a random person who just set it in. And it's just brilliant. And so I kind of had a lot of eclectic influences around me. One of the interesting stories of that is the fact that I think I've mentioned a few times in interviews as well, is that when I was about 7 years old, my dad was playing a Ravi Shankar record. I remember kind of just saying to my dad, how are they doing that? Created that trick. And he said, what trick? I said, it sounds like he's playing really fast. And my dad said, no, that's Ravi Shankar. He plays like that. And I said, he can't do. No one can move their fingers like that. So I spent ages, like I just was interested in guitar. And when I was about eight, I used to just sit there for ages trying to figure out how the hell anyone can move their fingers like that. And I remember I was actually at Pandit G. Ravi Shankar's deathbed. I was by his side when he passed away. And Anushka Shankar, his daughter, had invited me to come be with him and with her at that time. And I was standing there and I remember holding his arm and thinking that's the same arm that inspired me when I was seven, and he just passed away. So it was kind of, it was a really strange moment for me to kind of think of that journey.
How incredibly moving.
Yeah, it was very powerful. Wow. It was a very powerful moment. So yeah, I mean, yeah, we had a lot of music in the house all the time, which was incredibly inspiring.
Were you a Top of the Pops family?
We did have Top of the Pops on a lot, yeah. I mean, it's a, I looked at it more as a curiosity than anything. I mean, I kind of, in a way, enjoyed the contrivance of it. It just looks so incredibly fake and artificial. And, and of course, you know, you could see a mile off, everyone was miming. And it was just like, how badly could they mime, you know? So it was stuff like that. So it was more fascination than anything. And obviously, I mean, in a way, if anything made it onto Top of the Pops, I immediately thought that's not credible music anymore. The second it got on Top of the Pops, I kind of wrote it off as kind of being uncool and uninteresting. So that's quite funny. I kind of had that opinion of anything that was commercial or, you know, it can't be good if it's commercial.
So you may have watched the old Grey Whistle Test instead then.
Definitely.
I guess
that was
originality.
That was my main go-to. And then later on, it was, what age would I have been when The Tube was on with Jules?
Of course.
But I think, definitely the old Grey Whistle Test. And I loved those old cartoons they'd put
on.
Yeah, which were like these old cartoons, American cartoons, like Betty Boop type things. And they'd have these kind of like characters chasing each other for ages in black and white, you know.
Over the top of a strange Frank Zappa song.
Exactly, yeah. I loved it. It's like really, really surreal, trippy kind of, you know, stuff. Obviously Whispering Bob Harris was a hero, and then Anne Nightingale, absolutely. I think some of the performances on there were just absolutely mind-blowing. And I mean, I was a guitar solo fanatic, I have to be honest, you know. I mean, it's funny because I very rarely solo on the guitar now. I did recently on Instagram with a Marvin Gaye cover we did What's Going On, but I very rarely do anything like that. But I grew up soloing a lot, listening to a lot of very diverse guitar soloists, but interestingly, I just prefer to listen to other people solo than me. But I think that was something I was doing a lot, listening to great players.
Well, incredibly, you work with Jeff Beck, and Jeff Beck is one of the greatest, of course. How was that?
Oh, amazing. That like? Well, he came over to my house in, I was in this kind of shared flat in Tooting at the time, and had a tiny little, you know, one room in that place, and there were a few of us there. Sanjeev Baskal was one of the people there as well, and four of us were sharing. And I remember everyone was frantically hoovering around the house when one day Paul McCartney came over. But I had amazing people come over, like Sinead O'Connor came over, and Jeff Beck came over one time. Shara Nelson as well, who sung on the Massive Attack track on Unfinished Sympathy. But yeah, Jeff Beck came over to learn Nadia, which is a track of mine from the album Beyond Skin. And I remember he was amazing. He was just so cool and humble and such a lovely guy. And is, you know, and I've met him many times since. And actually, I love it that he still covers that track. But he also performed it with me at the Royal Albert Hall in 2001, I think. And that was amazing to have him play that track on guitar. It was beautiful. The way he kind of really got into the Indian classical inflections. I mean, this is from a tradition of rag, you know, the rag itself is called desh. So when I talk about rag, that's a modal kind of idea. Mm-hmm. You could look at it that way. I mean, it's more complex than that, in that it's kind of based on seasons and times of day, and rag literally means colour. So it's actually, you know, the notes are different descending as they are ascending. But when Jeff Beck played it, he stuck totally to the rules of rag desh and really managed to capture the essence of that rag without knowing at all that that's where it came from. But a remarkable musician. I think he's, I mean, you know, I was a big fan of his from a very young age, and I'd read all about, you know, the history of the Yardbirds. And obviously I was kind of, as a guitar buff, I was kind of very interested in him and Hendrix and Page and all those incredible guitarists of that time. So, yeah, amazing.
There's not a lot of those kind of guys around, unfortunately.
Yeah, it's a kind of, it's a different world, isn't it? But I mean, I do think there are some incredible players. You see, if you watch reels on Instagram, you see phenomenal players. But sometimes I think they're very much about like speed merchants who just kind of play really fast. And
shredders.
Yeah, shredders. And it's kind of, it's interesting because I saw Joe Bonamassa doing that, who's a brilliant guitarist, absolutely fantastic, but he did it just to warm up, but he showed that you could do that, but he doesn't make that his thing, you know. He's just has incredible feel, and in fact he's on Jules's latest album.
My first album was produced by Francis Dunnery, who's an amazing player.
Right.
He was in a band called It Bites, and it was all about the discipline for him. When you first picked up a guitar, did you have that discipline?
No, I didn't. I literally sat there for ages fascinated by it. I laid it on its side a bit. What's his name? The blind guitarist who plays with the guitar on its side. I can't remember his name. Is it Jeff Healy or something?
Yeah, Jeff Healy.
Yeah, so I used to kind of literally just put it on its side and just do that and think, because I was a classical pianist by then, so I would just try and play it like that. And in some ways, I kind of wish I carried that on because it could be quite good. But I had no formal training for a very long time, actually, but I had all these incredible records around from my dad and my brothers, and so I'd just try and copy what they were doing. And so as time went on, I was just able to figure out a lot. And because I play piano anyway, what's great about the piano is it's everything. You can derive all knowledge, musical knowledge, from piano and really get into understanding scales and relationships and so on. So I could apply all of that understanding to the guitar and figure it out, really.
But you can't take a piano to a party and coo a girl off a sofa, but you can with a guitar.
Fair enough. Well, I can't argue with you. It sounds like you've got that experience.
No, I don't. I don't. But I know a lot of guitar players that have shacked up in that kind of way.
You know, I mean, for me, the romance of the guitar was actually much more in just the power of it. And I don't know, it was just such an incredibly beautiful sound and so versatile. So, I mean, I wanted to just be a really good guitarist. I didn't really care about anything else. It's interesting, I never really cared about the trappings of anything to do with music other than music. You know, music was everything. Yeah, because it was freedom of expression in a way that I think I never had in anything else. And I think, you know, I talked about the fact that when I met that English teacher, it felt like a liberation in lots of ways. But I never really had that until then, you know, apart from through music. And music allowed me to kind of explore scales and ideas and feelings and emotions in a way nothing else ever had.
So there was a complete discipline to it. Then you must have spent hours working on it.
I'd be playing, you know, up to like 4 hours a day on the piano and 4 hours on the guitar. So I'd almost every opportunity I got, you know, from the age of about, well, 5 to about 11, I was obsessed with music to the point of just practicing scales, practicing piano pieces, practicing guitar. You know, I'd listen to people and I'd try and copy exactly what they'd done. I had a little cassette recorder when I was a little bit older, about 10 or 11. It was a Jones cassette tape recorder. I remember if you held down the switches or whatever, the buttons in a certain way, you could actually slow down the track. So I'd do that and then I'd go, okay, and listen and then try and copy bit by bit what people were doing. Yeah, it was kind of obsessive copying and imitation, but also improvisation. You know, there were lots of guitarists who made me want to do that, but when you heard people like Paco de Lucia or John McLaughlin, you had no choice but to slow them down. It's like, what the hell just happened, you know? And also, you know, I mean, I was kind of listening to every type of music, you know, lots of country guitarists and heavy rock guitarists and a whole range of people.
I mean, I was very lucky to be in a band with like Jules on piano, of course, but Glenn Tilbrook, who's an incredible guitar player. And
I've heard,
whenever we tour, sometimes my jaw drops to the floor, and the discipline of his playing, his notation is just absolutely perfect. I'm in total awe of that kind of performance, because people are drawn to that.
Yeah.
People are drawn to the skill that you have.
Well, I mean, I don't know about whether they're drawn to my skill particularly, but I think, yeah, I mean, it was interesting with Glenn Tilbrook because I met him, I've met him a couple of times now, but I've had a really good conversation with him. The first time I met him, I was, I can't remember, we were at some party of some kind. I think it was a filmed party for the BBC of some kind. But I remember chatting to him for ages and thinking he was such an interesting bloke. He did a guitar solo on one of your famous singles. What was it? Which I thought was a really good solo.
Another nail in my heart was that instead of a second verse, there was a guitar solo, which was like,
might
wow.
Might have been that. Yeah, yeah. Because I remember looking up and going, oh, wow, this is a really good guitar solo. It's like, I didn't. And also, this is the other thing with you guys, is that there was a friend of mine at school called Trevor Durbridge, who was the son of a famous broadcaster called Don Durbridge. And Trevor actually played flamenco and was really into his guitar playing. But we used to chat a lot about songwriting. And he said there's only two bands that he thinks have great songwriting skills. One is The Beatles and one is Squeeze.
And
I always thought, yeah, he's right, you know, because I'd listened to a lot of different types of music, but I'd say, yeah, those are really good songs. You know, it's kind of like some bands you kind of think, oh, no, that's really skillful songwriting. Like Crowded House, I think, are great songwriters, for example. I mean, you know, you'll think there's a real craftsmanship in the way that that's structured as a song. And sometimes, you know, you'll hear a song and you'll think, well, yeah, I don't know if I'll remember that in even 5 minutes, let alone 5 years. But I mean, you know, but I don't know if that's the test of a great song. I don't know what it is, you know. But
no,
I think you kind of feel it when you hear it. And I think you guys were brilliant at that.
It's all about feelings. I totally agree.
Yeah.
So was there much live music around Rochester in those days when you were growing up? There was, really.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that's what I was saying. There were a lot of Medway bands. I mean, you know, the Pop Rivets, for example, with Billy Childish and a lot of those. Yeah, so there was the whole kind of Medway scene. You know, there was Billy Childish and then there was, you know, the Prisoners, who I kind of played with a tiny bit at school. And then there was, you know, with James and people like that and Graham Day. And then there was also another band called The Dentists. There was The Milkshakes. They were all, but it was kind of like all kind of like coming out of that kind of semi-punk scene, very kind of guitar-based bands that kind of wanted to make strong statements that they were against everything. But I got really inspired by Rock Against Racism because, you know, I remember just being in awe of Tom Robinson and also of bands like Steel Pulse and all those bands that kind of marched from Trafalgar Square to Mile End, I think it was, in protest at what was going on at the time. I mean, fascinatingly, it was in protest at stuff that had happened originally around Eric Clapton and around David Bowie. I was really blown away by the idea that there was this whole movement that was about kind of challenging racism. And I loved Steel Pulse anyway, and I thought they were fantastic, but also The Clash. And for me, those bands were quite inspiring in terms of what they were saying. I think that actually fed a little bit into the Medway scene slightly, and it certainly fed into the way I thought about music. You should try and find meaning within your music and think about the statement you want to make.
And did you have early ambitions that you feel that you've fulfilled?
Well, well, apart from studying law and accountancy, no. No, I mean, yeah.
Oh, yeah, of course, law, yeah.
Yeah, that was a weird aberration for me. But, I mean, I was never cocky enough to imagine, I wish I had been, to imagine that I could make a living out of music. I just didn't know if that was possible. And and particularly as an Asian kid, it's hard to express to anyone or explain to anyone how much racism kind of affected everything. If you're about the only Asian kid around, you genuinely walk around feeling inferior to some degree. I just never thought I could be popular in any way. You know, it just didn't strike me that that was a possibility. So I always thought I've got to be playing to back up other people, you know, but I can't possibly have my own voice. You know, no one would be interested. So there were no role models at the time that I could look at. It was only later on that I kind of was able to kind of listen to, say, Massive Attack remixing Nusrat Fateh Ali Khan, think, oh wow, that's incredible, you know. Or or I could hear the possibilities of Indian musicians being incorporated in bands and so on and keeping their identity, but I didn't really feel that that was possible for me. However, I did feel ambitious in my musicianship and composition. You know, I wanted to be the best I could be. So I would just kind of immerse myself in music in every way I could and just enjoy music, you know. So I think my ambitions were about musical ability and musical understanding more than anything.
Did that make you feel like you were in a safe place when you started writing songs?
100%. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, songwriting and writing instrumental pieces, you know, it was so cathartic, and it was also a sanctuary, you know, in lots of ways, from aggression, from violence, which I'd experienced a lot, and, you know, a lot of hate. I got to the point where I was used to it, and I was shocked when I didn't experience it when I went to university. So when I went to study law at Liverpool University, I was expecting the same levels of racism that I'd grown up with. And I was like, where are all the racists? I don't get it. You know, I honestly was... When somebody actually sat down with me, a woman called Sarah Stevens, I remember her name was, and she actually sat down with me and she chatted with me for a while. And I remember she talked about the fact that she'd, at school, I mean, she'd studied Sikhism. I mean, I'm not Sikh, I'm from a Hindu background, but I was just amazed that she knew about Sikhism and she knew about other religions and other cultures. And I thought, wow, I've never met this before. I've never come across that. So that astonished me. I just didn't expect it. I didn't expect people to have an understanding of other cultures or other traditions.
What was it like going from Rochester to Liverpool? Was it a romantic journey?
It was amazing. It blew my mind to be around other people and to have that level of freedom. And I was studying law, but I was mainly playing in local bands and kind of, you know, and going out and getting pissed in the evenings. But I was kind of, but having said that, it was just, it was a real experience. I mean, you know, I'd had that to some degree playing with bands, you know, before when I was at school. I played with lots of bands and so on, and I got used to that. But it was quite a parochial kind of place to be at that time. And then to suddenly be playing with local jazz bands or quartets or even funk bands, and I'd join everything that I could find and do gigs, you know. That was amazing. That was a great time to kind of just meet people and find incredibly talented people all over the place, you know, in Liverpool. There were a lot of brilliant musicians there.
Alongside our weekly guests, in each episode we'll be meeting other musicians from around the UK who've been supported by Help Musicians during these turbulent and troubling times during COVID. The charity has supported over 500 musicians to continue their professional development. These beneficiaries are singers, songwriters, composers from rock and pop and classical, and they're all here to tell their story.
My name's Philip Herbert. I'm a musician and a composer. I'm based in Leeds at the moment. I operate within classical music, but I have eclectic musical interests. For instance, I've just written a piece for an ensemble called the Nevis Ensemble that celebrated the season of spring. And I took as my inspiration a rag from Indian classical music called the Basant Wakari rag. I gave the piece a title called Punarjam, which is a Hindu word which refers to rebirth, and it's a crossover piece straddling Indian classical music and folk rock music. I enjoyed working on a project called Balare to Dance, and this project was about celebrating internationalism as well as the Olympic and Paralympic Games of London 2012. It was about taking a journey around the world through music. So for instance, you'd have Bocarinis Fandango and you'd associate that with Spain. And we had music from Cuba, Argentina, the African diaspora, India, and Mexico. And on stage, we had all these instruments, some of them from various world music traditions. And then we had instruments from classical traditions. And it was just great that these two traditions could come together to make music. I've been aware of Help Musicians for a while. And when I was preparing for Balare to Dance, they gave me a bursary to do some research and development so I could understand some of the musical traditions I was trying to explore in the compositions I was going to write. And I also had a really good time with the Transmission Fund from Help Musicians. It enabled me to attend a course that looked at writing music for film. with a brilliant composer by the name of Matthias Nielsen, a well sought after composer for film, TV, TV games, you name it, he does it. I felt much more open to embracing commissions after having done that course. And one of the things I do like about help musicians is that they think about the musician and the benefits that they need without all these strings attached.
Help Musicians is a charity for music creators of all genres across the UK, providing a lifetime of support when it's needed most. To find out how they can help you or to support their work, find them on all social media platforms or visit helpmusicians.org.uk. I was very lucky once. Trilok Gurtu came to my house to record an album, and we were having a conversation over breakfast, and he asked me what I did, and I said, well, I'm primarily a lyricist. And he said, would I write him some lyrics? So I did. The rhythm of his music was extremely complicated, therefore the lyrical fall had to be extremely complicated. But we managed to write 5 or 6 songs. But the most important thing about that relationship was the spiritual journey that he took me on. Have you worked with people like that that have given you the same sort of spiritual experience?
Well, Trilok is one of the people that I'd say, because I've worked with him, and he's what an incredible guy. He speaks like 12 languages or something as well, doesn't he? He's such an incredible intellectual, but he's also very, he's so excited all the time. He's got such energy, which is so infectious as well. I mean, have I worked with people who've taken me on a spiritual journey? I think almost every collaboration has done that. I mean, Ashwin Srinivasan is an incredible bansuri player from India, and his understanding of rag is phenomenal. I love working a lot with Indian classical musicians because they've been really trained in a way that is so different from the Western classical tradition. But there have been a few people like that. I mean, Devinder Singh is probably the person who's the most spiritual human being I've ever met, in that he's got incredible knowledge of the history of Indian religion and theology and Hinduism and Sikhism and so on, but also, you know, he really understands music in a way that feels like it comes from communing with the universe. I've never come across that with anyone else. He's extraordinary. And it's almost through osmosis that he seems to absorb information and musical prowess. I mean, the guy has ludicrous ability on the tabla and also on the sarod and sitar. He's a great classical singer. He appears on Beyond Skin. Yeah, he was incredibly inspiring to me. Just as a human being, I thought he was one of the most beautiful human beings I've ever met. Such a kind and thoughtful and compassionate person who seemed to be able in a second to see right into people's souls and bring that through in the way he would express music.
I remember seeing Anushka Shankar play once with her father by her side, and the respect for each other's space was moving. It was at the Albert Hall for George Harrison's memorial show, and you don't really get that in pop music. You don't get that soul, that spiritual connection.
Well, I mean, obviously, you know, there's several layers to that. I mean, Anushka being her father's daughter, but I mean, also that is built into the Indian classical tradition, that whole guru-disciple kind of thing. So she was his disciple as well as his daughter, and studied sitar under his tuition. But he was somebody to respect. You know, when I talked to him about politics, or when I talked to him about humanity, or when I talked to him, I mean, he was just somebody who just, he was awe-inspiring in the same way, on the same level as when I met Nelson Mandela. You know, I was kind of in awe of what he had to say and the way his mind worked, which was just incredibly open and knowledgeable and humane, you know. And he was the one who kind of talked about the idea of the rag, the Indian classical rag, that he was a medium for it to pass through, that he didn't create it himself. He just opened himself up. And again, it's this idea of communing with the universe. And it's something I talked about a few times in relation to the fact that Beethoven did the same thing when he became completely deaf, that he actually, in 1816, when he was 46, that he actually started writing down words from Hindi scripture. it was from then on that I think his work became even more profound and incredible. In fact, his best work is in the latter half of his life when he couldn't hear a thing. So all of that music was coming from somewhere. And I do believe it was coming from this innate ability we have, if we tap into it, to commune with the universe. There is music out there already undiscovered in the way that the universe, the patterns of the universe exist, and the sounds of the universe are kind of out there for us to discover all the time.
Yeah, when I was speaking to Evelyn Glennie, she was saying it's about feeling, not hearing.
Oh, yeah. I mean, she's amazing that way. I always find it unbelievable that she can do what she does, but it's through vibration, isn't it? I mean, it's like she blows me away as a percussionist. She's just so incredible. And again, somebody who's unbelievably inspiring. I can't even imagine how she can do that. You know, I mean, how can you be totally involved and engaged with musical expression, you know, when you can't hear the sounds, you know? So it does show that it's something that's beyond sound. And I've been talking about this a lot over lockdown, that that I believe that music is actually is greater than sound itself, that it is actually something that is coming from feeling.
It is. Unfortunately, most people hear it through tiny little earphones through an iPhone.
Yeah, absolutely.
It sounds terribly compressed. Do you enjoy producing other people?
Yeah, I love it. I mean, I've really enjoyed working with Jules recently. What a lovely, he's such a lovely guy, isn't he?
He's incredible, yeah.
He's got the excitement of a young boy, you know, but at the same time, you know, about everything and about music. He's just always engaged, curious, but he's also a brilliant player and just so versatile and so giving as well when he's playing with other people, and generous. So I really enjoyed producing him. That was fantastic. And such incredible artists on that album as well.
Really?
I mean, you know, like David Gilmour, for God's sake, you know, like or Gregory Porter or Herbie Hancock, or, you know, I mean, these are incredible people. But I've enjoyed producing a whole range of people. I mean, producing Anishka, I produced her album Traces of You, and meeting Norah Jones was incredible as well, her sister, Anishka's sister. I mean, isn't that amazing that Ravi Shankar actually, you know, was father to two totally independent styles of music, but they're all Grammy winners. I mean, you know, Norah Jones, nothing to do with Anishka's success, and Anishka nothing to do with Norah Jones' success.
Completely separate.
And yet, look at that. You know, I mean, people didn't even know that Norah Jones was Ravi Shankar's daughter until quite late in her career. You know, it was just so that musicality. They're kind of living proof that musicality is something you do inherit something. I do find it really an amazing thing when you do produce people, because you learn something every time when you're working with different artists about how they think and how they approach sound and how they approach their own feelings as well. So,
It seems to me that because of the pandemic, a lot of people have gone up in the loft and rediscovered music for the first time in absolutely years, which is a great thing. And, you know, Spotify seemed to have really raced ahead with their ability to connect to people around the world. Do you think Spotify could be a bit more generous with their rewards?
Well, I don't know many musicians who don't think that. But I think in a way, to kind of particularly pick out Spotify, I think it's about streaming in general.
And I think it's
kind of, that's got to change, and the system of how that works has got to change. I mean, you know, YouTube and so on. I mean, there are, these are market leaders, so we have to look at what they're doing. But at the same time, I just think, why is it any different to broadcasting? It shouldn't be. So there should be greater rewards that come from it, but also the distribution of those rewards and how that works. I mean, strikes me as very strange that it goes to publishers and record companies to then redistribute income to the artists. And I kind of find that a very odd way. You know, if one person is listened to a great deal, it doesn't mean that they're going to be paid that money. You know, it's kind of, this is the point, it's kind of changed the whole way in which music works. It's definitely not a fair system. It's inequitable inherently. And then on top of that, it's not enough, because it's actually not really working on the same basis as broadcasting. So it's not policed in the same way, and it's not kind of subject to rules that evolved over a long time, you know, around broadcasting that people fought for. You know, I mean, musicians had to fight for those rights and rules. And then they all went out the window suddenly. And you know, if you go back to Napster and if you go back to all these things that happened in the early part of the century, you know, it's kind of, it changed everything really, and it changed the respect that musicians have for their own art as well as how people regard them, because in a way it kind of made their work more disposable or less kind of meaningful. I mean, you know, when I was young, when we were young, you know, you'd have an album, it'd be a precious thing, you know, you'd have it on vinyl, you'd take care of it because you didn't want it to get scratched, all of that stuff, and you'd read through the sleeve notes and you cared about every single track and what was going on, and you'd really follow information about the artists. That's not the case now. It's a very different world. And I think even the whole thing with bundling, I think, you know, it was Estelle with American Boy. There was a whole change in the rules, because what happened was, I think Apple had a bit of a battle with Warner Brothers. Warner's wanted to actually say, well, if you bought American Boy, you should buy the whole album. And I think Apple at the time said, no, you're not going to decide that, we are. And so they had a bit of a battle about that time, and in the end, Apple won. So as a result of that, people just can pick out tracks from albums and not really engage with an album. And so in a way, it kind of spelt the demise of albums in lots of ways digitally. There's a lot of things that have happened over the last 20 years that have kind of been difficult to watch as a musician, because we all really value music. And I think that each of these changes has kind of devalued music to some degree.
So it makes the live performance even more important.
Yeah, and when it can happen again.
When it can happen.
I mean, yeah, this is the thing. So, I mean, yeah, I mean, I think what's happened is that, you know, musicians have been smacked about and pushed about and shoved into a corner and stamped on and just told, well, you know, you should be grateful for what you have. And then the audacity recently of people like Lord Frost or Oliver Dowden and so on, you know, talking in terms of the obligations of musicians to actually petition the EU for visas and so on. It's like, hang on a minute. You know, it's kind of, it's pretty outrageous what's happened to musicians. I can't believe that the condescension. I mean, the government, who has screwed up in so many ways, I'm not going to even make any bones about that.
Sure.
You know, and yet musicians bring, what is it, 11 billion or whatever. It's a huge industry that is massive economic benefit to the country. And yet musicians are spoken to, artists are spoken to, as if they are a burden on the economy. I mean, you know, it's the total hypocrisy of watching, you know, football matches where people can gather together in their droves with no problem.
Exactly.
And, you know, so I said when WOMAD was cancelled, well, what about if we play a football match halfway through the set? You know, I mean,
absolutely.
It strikes me as so bizarre that, you know, there's literally one rule for them. And so people have said, as opposed to calling it the Department of Culture, Media and Sport, just call it the Department of Sport. Yeah, because it doesn't really stand for anything else at the moment.
It doesn't.
Yeah.
And yet, you know, I remember reading that Paul McCartney, his income every year was more than British Steel. I mean, why can't they sit up and understand that?
Yeah, well, that's the thing. I mean, you know, it's, I don't think those are their priorities, if I'm really honest.
Of course not.
And I kind of think, you know, we could get into a much deeper discussion,
debate.
I mean there are very different motivations for how things work than we're actually told in everyday media.
It's incredible to discover that if you move to Nashville, if you're a songwriter, there's 0% tax.
Well, there you go. And someone I know moved there recently for that reason.
Yeah. We're all be moving there.
Fair enough. I mean, well, there are quite a few places in the world where you could do that.
Rochester?
Not Rochester, sadly not. But otherwise, I'll be there in a shot.
So what would be like the highest point of your career that you look back and you go, wow, did that really happen? Did I really meet that person?
Well, I mean, the clue's in the last part of it, which was meeting Nelson Mandela in his home. I think that that's not just the high point in my career, that's the high point in my life, I think. You know, actually, he was somebody that I'd obviously admired for many, many years, and I just read his book Long Walk to Freedom, and then just to literally walk into his house in Johannesburg, and I finished the last page literally in his garden. Literally finished that page, and then I got out of the car that brought me there and I just went straight in and met Nelson Mandela, having read his entire biography, his autobiography. And I have never been so much in awe of another person. And also there was no disappointment in any way. The guy was incredibly gracious, thoughtful, and blew my mind with stuff that happened. I think, again, it's one of the things that I've recounted quite a few times is when his PA came into the room and said, Madiba, which is what they called him, the president's on the phone to speak to you. And he looked at me and just said, how many more questions have you got? And I said, I don't know, two or three. And he goes, could you ask him to call me back in 10 minutes? Oh. And I was like, and for me, that was a big moment because I thought, oh my God, the guy's actually genuine and egalitarian. He sees everyone the same. He'd never met me before. And I nearly cried because I'd read about him at Riviona when he said, and you can read these things and think, well, that's grandiose language when somebody says, I stand for the struggle of all people against oppression, not just black South Africans. All of that kind of really, that could be political rhetoric. You don't know, you know. It's like, but then you meet the guy and then he does something to him that's small like that. And you just sit there absolutely, you know, humbled by what he just did, and you just think, wow, that's amazing. So I was quite choked up for the rest of that.
You were. Like, yeah,
because I don't think he realized what he just done. He just thought, and that's what I mean, he was just a person who struck me, and he was just incredibly engaged. And to him, I could have been the Pope, I could have been whoever, you know. He would engage with me in the same way. Amazing.
So to balance out the scales, what would be your lowest point?
Wow, I thought about this. I mean, quite a few times. I mean, what's the low point of my career? Is that what you're saying? Low point of my career?
I think so, yeah. Would it be going and seeing Jules Holland's train set? I'm thinking, I wish I could have done that.
No, that's great. Let me just think. What's been the low point? I think it's probably, I went through a very difficult patch, strangely enough, between Beyond Skin and Prophecy, where I lost a lot of self-esteem or self-confidence, basically. Part of it was because I was in a little bit of I got into a legal battle with my previous record company. I got into a situation where I was in debt. I was kind of worried about almost everything. I felt shortly after I made Beyond Skin, and it hadn't really come out properly, but I felt like I didn't really know what I was doing anymore or why I was doing it, because I'd spent all this time on this album and I kind of wanted to make this album, but I didn't even know why, and I didn't know how people would react to it. But it was amazing when people really, you know, it sold a lot of records, it went gold, and it continued to sell, and then I got the Mercury nomination, and then I got signed by V2, and everything just changed overnight almost. It was quite incredible. In fact, it was just like about 4 months where the previous 2 years were almost just totally wiped out. I was on tour, I had my tour support was taken away from me because I was in a legal battle with the company, so I just ended up like with zero money and just thinking, I don't know how to carry on, you know. I'll just have to go back to a normal job, and I didn't really want to do that because I'd promised myself I never would. I was that far from just thinking I'm going to jack it all in.
Wow, that's a difficult place to be in, isn't it? I've sort of been very close to that myself, and then I kind of have to own who I am and what my journey is, regardless of how dark things can be.
Yeah,
some moments I can think, okay, you know, I was born to do this, and there is nothing else that I could do, and so I have to accept my shortcomings and the world around me, because it's not all going to be the Garden of Eden. It's going to be whatever it is in that day.
Yeah. I have to say, Chris, I mean, you're someone who's incredibly inspiring. I mean, the fact that you did these songwriting days and workshops, you know, I remember coming over to yours all those years ago, and there was Turane Breaks there, and there was some great artists who were around, and I really found that incredibly inspiring. I really enjoyed that time. And who's the guy from Wet Wet Wet?
Marty Pella.
Yeah, he was great. I mean, there was some brilliant
Jane Birkin.
Yeah, there was some great artists there, and it was just such a nice atmosphere. And again, it felt like a safe space. I mean, this is something that you're very good at, is creating a safe space where people feel that they can be themselves and find their own voice, but also find a new collective voice with people they might meet and collaborate with.
That's very kind.
Oh, man, you know, totally. I loved that time. That was great.
Oh, thank you very much. We'll keep coming back, as they say.
I would love to.
And thank you, Nitin Sawhney, for your time on this podcast for the charity Help Musicians. And it will definitely inspire a lot of people.
Cheers.
Thank you.
Thank you.
God bless.
Nice one.
I really enjoyed that journey. We went all over the place and came back again. It was extraordinary to learn that, like me, Nitin used to sit in school and write poetry to pass the time. His dedication to his music is a huge inspiration. And like all the people I speak to on my podcast, we do have some things in common. Except I have to say, I've never had a cup of tea with Nelson Mandela. Thanks for listening to I Never Thought It Would Happen with me, Chris Difford. You can find out more about Help Musicians at www.helpmusicians.org.uk. And don't forget to subscribe to the podcast and please leave us a review, hopefully a good one. We'd love to know what you think and who you'd like us to feature in future shows. See you on the next episode and keep coming back. I Never Thought It Would Happen is a Gimme Sugar production for Help Musicians.